Last time we spoke about Operation Reckless, Operation Persecution, and the Japanese retreat in New Britain. General Douglas MacArthur unleashed his two amphibious assaults, opening up the West New Guinea campaign. Both Operation Reckless and Persecution achieved complete surprise upon the Japanese. Multiple Japanese units already performing withdrawals were caught in the chaotic new flight when the Allies landed and began seizing key territories such as Hollandia and Aitape. The Japanese commanders fell into disarray, leaving some to seize command and order further withdrawals in the face of a hopeless battle. Yet again, forces already used to retreating through rough terrain without adequate provisions were hitting the jungle track. Morale was all but collapsing in New Guinea. Over in New Britain, matters were similar as the Japanese continued to retreat under heavy pressure from American patrols. Competent commanders would lose their lives beside their men in a hopeless battle. This episode is The Drive to Mitkinya. Welcome back to the Pacific War Week by Week podcast. I'm your dutiful host, Greg Watson. But before we begin, I just wanted to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more. So go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, the Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, if you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I just released a 2-hour-long documentary on the Opium Wars. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where I have exclusive podcasts. Recently, I've had a lot of people join up. Some saying they came from this very podcast, so thanks a lot, you guys are awesome. For just $2 a month, you get access to all the exclusive podcasts, early access to all of my work, and more goodies. Please check it out. Operation Reckless and Persecution were tremendous successes. There was very little opposition for the men advancing upon Hollandia. The Japanese simply did not even attempt to defend their well-defended defenses there. The drive towards Hollandia's airfields were led by the 1st Battalion, 186th Regiment. From Limak Hill to Brinkman's Plantation, they did encounter some opposition, but it was scattered and uncoordinated. Colonel Oliver Newman was very cautious. He believed thousands of Japanese were still around the airfields. Just before they came across the airfields, they found large, undefended Japanese supply dumps. This would be one of many Japanese supply dumps captured through the following days. As General Eichelberger recalled, "There were more than 600 supply dumps. There were clothing dumps as high as houses. There were ammunition dumps everywhere. There were pyramids of canned goods and tarpaulin-covered hills of rice which looked like Ohio hapsacks. There were sake and beer. There were tons and tons of quinine and other medical supplies which, as a result of our landing, never reached the Japanese troops at the front. I believe Hollandia was the richest prize, supply-wise, taken during the Pacific War." These types of discoveries indicated the Japanese were extremely desperate. By May the 4th, Major General William Gill's 32nd Division had just arrived at Aitape to relieve the 163rd Regiment, who were earmarked to take part in the next amphibious assault. The terrain alongside the weather was dreadful at Hollandia, making it impossible to provide the needed airfields suitable for heavy bombers without some legendary engineer work. General MacArthur considered it necessary to seize and develop new heavy bomber airfields in the Wakde-Sarmi-Biak region in order to neutralize enemy bases in the Western Carolines. To be honest, given the track records of these amphibious assaults in causing absolute mayhem for the Japanese commanders, forcing them to keep on running, it was a great idea to just keep the pace up. With the knowledge General Tagami's 36th Division was still in the region, and that the enemy might still seek to reinforce that said area before the Allies could land there, MacArthur initially planned to send the full 41st Division against the Wakde-Sarmi area on May the 15th, once the Hollandia fields were ready to support the amphibious assault. However, supply congestion at Hollandia's beaches were thwarting such designs. Admiral Barbie proposed that D-Day be postponed until May the 21st, and he gave two reasons for the postponement. First, tides would be higher in the Whangdae area on the 21st, more so than on the 15th. Second, postponement would allow orderly and complete preparations to be made. Congestion was severe at the Hollandia beaches, where the bulk of the 41st Division was staged. Lack of litterage and beach space combined with inadequate road net hampered unloading equipment, supplies, and troops, which was pouring into the Hollandia area. The arrival of such supplies and units, some of which had to be reloaded for Whangdae's army, seriously interfered with the mounting of the 41st Division. As such, General Kruger decided the operation could be started no earlier than the 16th, but that unless important strategic considerations dictated otherwise, the 21st would be much more preferable. Additionally, a number of engineer and Air Force organizations were scheduled to arrive at Hollandia on the 12th, either for the employment there or to be staged at the Whangdae's army area. The shipping bringing these units to Hollandia was needed to support the Whangdae phase of the new operation, which could not begin until the vessels were reloaded. As beach congestion at Hollandia remained a major problem, this reloading could not be accomplished quickly. It was therefore proposed that the Whangdae landings be postponed at least another day to the 17th. Although MacArthur initially approved the proposed delay, new aerial photography of the coastal area from Saarmi eastward to Whangdae indicated the ground conditions of the region were not suited for heavy bomber airstrips. Thus, MacArthur decided that the Saarmi portion of the operation could be axed, and instead they would focus on Whangdae Island, slated for D-Day, May the 17th. 10 days after the capture of Whangdae, or as soon as the airfields were repaired, the Allies would then hit Biak, where most suitable airfield sites were known to exist. General Doe thus prepared for the Whangdae landings, codenamed Operation Tornado, while General Fuller's remaining regiments were expected to seize the aerodrome areas on Biak. Over on the other side, General Anami planned to send the 36th Division over to perform an immediate counterattack against Hollandia, but he was denied. General Adichie over to the east had more freedom to act. The 18th Army had found itself cut off from all provisions and supplies, thus deprived of every possibility of rejoining the 2nd Area Army west of Hollandia, for the crucial defense of Western New Guinea. Because of this, General Adichie reasoned the best move for his 55,000 troops was to perform some quick actions before their strength was all sapped out. Thus, on April the 26th, Adichie ordered the 20th, 41st, and 51st Divisions to prepare a counterattack against the enemy beachhead at Aitipe. Adichie hoped that such a bold action against his enemy's rear might force a major diversion of the enemy eastwards, in turn hampering their drive against Western New Guinea. Now back in mid-February, the Japanese were adjusting their forces in the Central Pacific. They had established the 31st Army in Saipan, formed around the 52nd and 29th Division, led by Lieutenant General Obata Hideyoshi. The bulk of the 52nd Division, led by Lieutenant General Mugikura Shinazaburo, had landed in Truk mid-February. Lieutenant General Takeshina Takisi's 29th Division, meanwhile, was still in progress of traveling to the Marianas, escorted by destroyers Kishinami, Asishimo, and Okinami. The bulk of the division departed Busan on February the 24th, but the convoy would be torpedoed some 200 kilometers south of Okidachijima by the submarine Trout on February the 28th. The 18th Regiment, led by Colonel Monma Kentaro, suffered 1,657 deaths, including its commanding officer, and 570 wounded. Because of this, the 18th Regiment was landed at Saipan to recover. The 50th Regiment was diverted to land on Tianjin under the command of Colonel Ogata Keiji, and the 38th Regiment was sent to Guam on March the 4th. Now, Allied submarine interceptions of these troop movements was no mere coincidence. The submarine activities were frequently guided by magic intelligence, relating to ship movements which were collected by intercepting and decrypting encoded radio transmissions. The IGN routinely broadcast the location and intended route of convoys under its protection, and decrypting these messages allowed Allied naval commanders to alert submarines in the vicinity of convoys. The submarine commanders were free to plan their interception and attack when conditions were most favorable. The IGN's faulty anti-submarine doctrine also contributed to Japan's shipping losses. The Navy had placed a low priority on protecting merchant shipping from submarine attacks before and during the early years of the war, and convoys were not routinely assembled until 1943. Vast swaths of Japanese shipping were being sunk in early 1944. There were two major reasons for this. Number one, obviously the IGN were greatly diminished and thus Allied submarines were operating further into enemy territory. Number two, fixing the torpedo issue, yes, those pesky Mark 14s and 15s, was now really hitting hard and providing enormous results. In response to the emerging crisis, the Japanese established the Grand Escort Fleet Headquarters, under the overall command of Admiral Oikawa Koshiro, to coordinate convoys and implement a standard doctrine. The first order of business was to increase the average size of Japanese convoys from 5 ships to large convoys of 10 to 20 ships, in order to assign more escort ships to protect against enemy submarine activity. To further reinforce the Central Pacific, the Japanese also created 9 expeditionary units. These came from the forces of the 1st and 7th Kwangtung and 8th Korean armies. It was also decided to assign the 14th and 43rd divisions of Lieutenant Generals Inoue Sadai and Seito Yoshisugi to General Obata's command, designated Truck Sector Group. To support them, the IGN decided to combine the 4th Fleet and the 14th Air Fleet on March the 4th to form the Central Pacific Area Fleet, under Admiral Nagumo. Between March and April, the 31st Army was assigned the priority for shipping, so Nagumo would send a total of 11 large convoys, collectively known as the Matsuo Fleet, to bring said reinforcements to the Central Pacific. However, the deadly American submarines would hunt relentlessly to prevent these reinforcements, but they would only be able to sink the light cruiser Tatsuta, the destroyer Asanagi, 6 transports, and 1 submarine chaser, so the Matsuo Fleet was considered to be a large success. By mid-April, the success of the Matsuo Fleet allowed the IGN to allocate more shipping to the Secondary Army. Thus, the Takaichi Convoy was formed to carry the 32nd Division of Lieutenant General Aishi Yoshio and the bulk of the 35th Division to Western New Guinea. The large convoy consisted of 15 transports escorted by an unusually strong force under Admiral Kojiaka, consisting of the mine layer Shirataka, destroyers Asakaze, Shiratsuyu, Fujinami, and Kuri, the Miruka-class escort ship Kurahashi, Type D escort ships number 20 and number 22, gunboats Ataka, Aiji, minesweepers number 22 and number 101, submarine chaser number 37, number 38, and the Tamamaru. I do apologize for the long lists, but I'm not kidding. I've received multiple emails from people who say they want the lists and that they love the fact that I list all the ships, which I clearly can't continue to do because once we get to the Battle of the Philippines or, oh my god, the Battle of Leyte Gulf, yeah, no, that's not happening. So this force departed Shanghai on April the 17th en route for Manila. Unbeknownst to the Japanese Allied codebreakers, who were decrypting the radio signals, they had managed to figure out the convoy's departure and arrival points. The submarine Jack was given the coordinates and intercepted Kajioka's convoy around nightfall on April the 26th. Jack fired 19 torpedoes from a very long range, managing to sink the 5,425-ton freighter, the SS Yoshida, Maru No. 1. She had been carrying the entire 210th Regiment of the 32nd Division, 3,000 soldiers and their commander, Colonel Kaoke Yasumasa, all drowned with the ship. And it's moments like these I always find myself taking a step back. Thousands of men fighting all over these islands in the Pacific. Absolute carnage in places like New Guinea, Guadalcanal, later on in Peleliu. And one submarine, whoosh, an entire regiment is gone. The Allied submarine campaign during the Pacific War did a lion's share of work, and it was horrifying work. War is a terrible thing. The remaining convoy ships continued to Manila, and they arrived on April the 29th. Upon reaching Manila, Lieutenant General Ishi Yoshio learned that his 32nd Division was reassigned to the Secondary Army to further reinforce Western New Guinea, so a new convoy of 8 transports would resume the journey to New Guinea on May the 1st, carrying the bulk of the 32nd and 35th Divisions. You can bet, after hearing what happened to the 210th Regiment on the Yoshida Maru, these men were dreading to sail again. They had every reason to feel that dread, as the American intelligence operators figured out the convoy's departure and arrival information yet again. They pinpointed the convoy's route, speed, and daily noon positions, just about everything. This time the submarine Gunard intercepted Kajioka's convoy in the Celebi Sea on May the 6th. Gunard's captain, Commander Herb Andrew, submerged his boat and he made a cautious approach to avoid detection by aircraft. He reached a firing position 4 hours later and he fired 6 torpedoes at 2 transports. Only one of these torpedoes struck its mark, and a second salvo missed its intended targets but hit another transport. Andrews then turned his boat, and he fired further torpedoes from Gunnard's stern torpedo tubes, which hit a third transport. One of the Japanese destroyers then counterattacked Gunnard, forcing Andrews to break off his attack. The destroyer was traveling at too great a speed for its detection gear to function, however, and it did not damage the submarine, despite dropping approximately 100 depth charges. 2 hours later, Gunnard rose to periscope depth, and he found a major effort to rescue the troops and equipment from the torpedoed transports was underway. In the end, the attack successfully sank transports Edamaru, about 6,000 tons, Tajiamaru, 7,000 tons, as well as the cargo ship, the Tenjinsan Maru, another 7,000 tons. And although the Japanese rescue efforts were relatively successful, 1,290 troops were killed. The 4th Independent Mountain Artillery Regiment was completely destroyed and much of their equipment was lost. Due to the heavy losses, the Takeuchi convoy would finally dock at the Hamahara on May the 9th, where the remnants of the 32nd and 35th Divisions were ultimately unloaded. General Ikeda's 35th Division, including the 219th Regiment from Palau, were shipping over to Sorong, with the 219th left to guard the St. Andrew Strait Islands. General Ishii's 32nd Division was retained at Halmahera to garrison the island. The terrible loss of the Takeuchi convoy forced the Japanese leadership to acknowledge it was no longer possible to reinforce Western New Guinea. Thus, General Anami would have to fight with what he had on hand. Alongside this, the IGA General HQ decided to pull back the perimeter of the absolute defensive zone in the southern area to a line extending from Sorong to Halmahera, with units at Gelvink Bay, Biak, and Manakwari ordered to hold out as long as possible to delay the enemy advance. Anami did not like the orders one bit, as he believed the forward line should be aggressively defended to secure the valuable land-holding air bases between Palau and Western New Guinea. What Anami was not aware of was that the IGN Combined Fleet was preparing for the famed decisive naval battle in this area. This was part of Admiral Toyoda's Operation Ago. Under the plans elaborated by the Combined Fleet, the 1st Mobile Fleet, and the 1st Air Fleet, they were assigned the principal roles in the projected battle. The former assembled its surface strength at Tawi Tawi in the Sulu Archipelago on May the 16th, while the land-based units of the 1st Air Fleet continued to be widely deployed in the Marianas and the Carolines to take advantage of any tactical opportunity that might arise. Tawi Tawi was chosen as the main staging point for the 1st Mobile Fleet because of its proximity to both the refueling facilities of Balikpapan and to the sea area which the Navy High Command expected to be the scene of the decisive naval battle. It was also safely beyond the range of enemy land-based air power and afforded greater security against Allied intelligence than other anchorages in the Philippines. Orders are orders, thus Anami ordered General Tashima to hold onto Gelvink Bay at all costs while also continuing to secure this army area as a lifeline for the 18th Army, who were being cut off from east of Hollandia. While Admiral Ozawa's 1st Mobile Fleet assembled itself at Tawi Tawi for Operation Ago, and Admiral Kukada's 1st Air Fleet deployed its land-based units in the Marianas and Carolines, Admirals King, Nimitz, and Spruance had also been planning their invasion of the Marianas, aiming to secure Saipan, Tianjin, and Guam as advanced air and naval bases to allow for the strike against the Philippines, Formosa, and Okinawa. After the landings at Hollandia and Aitape, Admiral Mitscher's Task Force 58 realized there was very little opposition, and he still had plenty of strength to continue operating. Thus, Nimitz decided to carry out a preventive strike against Truk to ensure that the Japanese would not be able to build up their air power before the Marianas invasion, scheduled for June. Intelligence reports indicated the Japanese had been rebuilding their strength at Truk. Indeed, Truk's air garrison had grown enough to become a concern again. By late March, 30 flyable Zero fighters had been pieced together from aircraft destroyed during the February raids. Additionally, aircraft were being withdrawn from bypassed bases in the Marshalls and sent to Truk. By April, the Japanese had 104 flyable aircraft at Truk, 6 G4M twin-engine bombers, 12 D4Y dive bombers and reconnaissance bombers, 13 B5Ns or B6N torpedo bombers, 55 Zero fighters, 10 JIN-1 night fighters, and 8 float planes used for observation and reconnaissance. Moa No. 1 airfield housed G4Ms and 20 Zeros, while Eaton had the rest of the Zeros and all the night fighters. The single-engine bombers, such as the D4Ys, B5Ns, and B6Ns, were all at Param, with the float planes at Dublon. There were another 63 unserviceable aircraft scattered throughout Truk's airfields as well. Admiral Spruance's Fifth Fleet would also conduct a bombardment of Satawa and Panope Islands. On its return from Hollandia, Task Force 58 traveled to Truk, arriving shortly before dawn on April the 30th, and immediately tossed a fighter sweep consisting of 84 Hellcats. Five Nakajima bombers from Panam were aloft during a dawn sweep, something that had become a routine since February. Truk's radar detected the inbound U.S. aircraft when they were about 30 minutes out, shortly before the scouts interrupted radio report. The warning gave the Japanese ample time to launch air cover. Before the U.S. fighters arrived, Moa No. 1 airfield had scrambled 20 Zeros, eaten another 29, and eight Nakajima bombers at Param. Yet the 57 Japanese aircraft were simply brushed aside. Nearly 25 Zeros were shot down at the cost of just two Hellcats. Just like we saw in February, Task Force 58 began staggering airstrikes throughout the day. The carriers launched full deck loads, seeing fighters, dive bombers, and torpedo bombers continuously over Truk for the entire day. Task Force 58 performed 2,200 bomber sorties, 467 of which were flown by fighters carrying bombs. In all, U.S. naval aircraft dropped 748 tons of bombs during the two-day operation. The Hinomaru No. 2, a 1,500-ton cargo ship, an auxiliary gunboat, was hit and heavily damaged by a bomb by an Avenger from the USS Cabot during the attack's first day. She would sink 4 days later on May the 4th. The Sapporo Maru, a 600-ton auxiliary provision store ship, was bombed on April the 30th, and she would sink north of Fifan. A 300-ton auxiliary mine layer, the Minzei Maru, and 20 other craft were also destroyed in the harbor during the 2 days of the raid. While a small haul, when compared to February's results, these losses further reduced the number of vessels remaining in the Truk Atoll. This increased the difficulty of moving supplies and personnel between the different islands in the lagoon, further decreasing Truk's usefulness as an outpost. Additionally, the Japanese submarine I-174 was detected 20 miles south of the atoll on May the 1st. Aircraft from the light carrier Monterey, teamed up with destroyers McDonaghy and Stephen Potter, sank the submarine. Whether the submarine was fleeing Truk or heading back to it after a patrol is not known. Its loss contributed to the decision to abandon Truk as a submarine base later on in 1944. The Japanese lost 23 auxiliary vessels and one submarine, but this time the American bombers also targeted Truk's shore facilities, giving special attention to the airfields at Moan and Aden, the Dumlon Naval Headquarters and the oil storage tanks, and Fifan's docks, warehouses, and ammunition dumps. On the morning of May the 1st, the Japanese attempted several straggling strikes against the American carriers, but none managed to cause any damage. The largest attack against the U.S. fleet contained 8 bombers, those being D-4Y-1 dive bombers and Nakajima torpedo bombers, which survived the first day's attack. They found Task Group 58.2 and Task Group 58.3 at 8:15 a.m., performing a series of attacks against aircraft carriers in both groups. Met by heavy anti-aircraft fire, they were shot down, most before they could even drop their torpedoes or bombs. Only one came close enough to drop a bomb, which fell near the Lexington but caused no damage. Task Force 58 continued to pound Truk throughout the day before finally retiring towards Majuro during the night. Based on interpretation of post-strike aerial photography, U.S. intelligence estimated about 40% of the buildings on Dumlon, 80% of those on Aten, 75% of those on Moan, 20% of the buildings on Fifan, 15% of those on Param, and 80% of those on Ulalu were destroyed during the airstrikes on April the 30th to May the 1st. Roughly 423 buildings and 6 hangars were destroyed. 44 others were damaged, 59 Japanese aircraft were shot down, and a further 60 were destroyed on the ground. 36 were left undamaged, and only 12 were about still flyable. All of this cost Mitscher 35 aircraft, with another 33 damaged. Furthermore, half of the airmen shot down were rescued by planes or submarines. Thus, the threat posed by Truk was yet again neutralized. After this, Admiral Montgomery's carrier Task Force 58 was given orders to hit Minami, Torishima, and Wake Island for mid-May. Leaving Majuro on May the 15th, Montgomery assembled his forces about 420 miles southeast of Marquis Island on the 17th. On the 19th, light carrier San Jacinto hunted for enemy picket boats north and west of Minami, Torishima. At 7:28 a.m., an Avenger of VT-9 and a Hellcat of VF-9 found and attacked an enemy trawler 475 miles north of Marquis Island. They dropped their bombs and strafed it with machine gun fire. No direct bomb hits were obtained, but the target was well covered with machine gun fire. The Japanese trawler was left dead in the water and down by the stern, with 1/4 miles of oil slick and debris behind it. No personnel were visible on the boat. Meanwhile, fleet carriers Wasp and Essex launched a pre-dawn fighter sweep. A flight of 4 night fighters launched at 5 a.m. from the Wasp on an intruder mission over Marcus Island, but for the Essex, they had to cancel their flight because their night fighters were having some mechanical issues. At 11:15, another air attack commenced. Aircraft dove through anti-aircraft bursts from bomb blasts occurring all over the island. At one time, the entire island was completely smothered by smoke and dust, but the anti-aircraft fire continued undiminished. After the planes left, explosions and fires continued on Marcus Island for some time. They managed to inflict a moderate amount of damage to the buildings, shot down one G4M, and sunk 2 small boats. But the Defender's anti-aircraft fire was ferocious, successfully shooting down 4 American planes, damaging another 69. On May the 21st, the San Jacinto rejoined the group and also reported striking one sampan. Montgomery's carriers then launched a series of composite carrier strikes against Wake Island on May the 23rd, further damaging many installations there and sinking a slugger and 3 barges, only at the cost of 1 plane. Yet that is going to be it for the carrier actions for today, as we now need to jump over to the Burma front. General Vinegar Joe was continuing his offensive, with the 22nd Division advancing south towards Ikangantong. General Liao's 65th Regiment plus the 3rd Bataan 66th Regiment were advancing down the Kemang Road when they ran into Japanese resistance north and west of Ikangantong. The 64th Regiment were kept behind to guard against the Japanese flank until May the 3rd, while the rest of the 22nd Division waited for better weather to perform a coordinated attack against the town. But this was Burma, and Burma is going to Burma. There was an outbreak of monsoons that quickly prevented the effective use of tanks and made supply movements over the Lido Road a nightmare. By June, about 1 inch of rain fell daily. Though supply convoys could still move from Lido to Xingbiwang, the combat trail from Xingbiwang south was very difficult. The road was graded to Tingkok Sakan, known as Milepost 164, and metalled almost to Milepost 138. However, rainfall had blocked the road over the flats north of Tingkok Sakan. At the end of June, the situation was unchanged. The Japanese stand at Kemang and the heavy rains immobilized the survey parties and the road trace. As the floodwaters rose in the valley, they effectively barred armor from moving south to Magong or Mitnyukinya. Thus, on May the 3rd, the 64th advanced east across the Kemang Road to try and cut a trail 500 yards south of Hulanhaka. The next day presented clearer skies, so the Chinese troops initiated their attack. Once Ikangantan fell, the 22nd Division would hold the area for several weeks while the first elements of Lieutenant General Pan Yuken's 50th Division arrived to the front to reinforce them. To the east, General Sun's 114th Regiment were engaging General Tanaka's 55th Regiment along the Lakrohika. To break the stalemate along the Lakrohika, the Chinese 114th Regiment had to clear away the Japanese observation posts in the hills. The 1st Battalion, 114th, on the regiment's eastern flank, cut around the flank of the 55th Regiment on April the 28th, while the 2nd Battalion, 114th, pushed the same Japanese unit back a few hundred yards. This bending process continued during the next 2 days. The 114th Regiment was well south of the enveloped Japanese flank and within half a mile of Wala. The 1st and 2nd Battalions of the 114th then began moving straight south, leaving behind them pockets of determined Japanese who held up the 3rd Battalion, 114th. The Chinese managed to envelop the Japanese, pushing them all the way to Wala. The 113th Regiment also came back into the line at the end of April to put frontal pressure on the Japanese positions along the Lakrohika and Tigramhika, while the 112th Regiment held it salient without attempting to move. Though the Japanese managed to stabilize their lines on the creeks east and west of Wala, a company of the 114th would cross the Nangimihika on May the 6th, thus starting the advance southwards again. 2 days later, the 114th's advance became general, while in the east, at Stilwell's order, the 112th began to gather its companies to take Warong. On the 9th, the 114th Regiment finally took East Wala and Hilgalgi, and subsequently linked with the 112th Regiment pushing towards Warong. The 114th's penetration, driving deeper into the Japanese lines, began to approach the 112th's outpost just north of Manpin. By the 12th, the 114th and 112th regiments were able to maintain communications, with very few Japanese between them. The 114th's penetration further weakened the position of the Japanese facing the 113th regiment, which in turn began to roll up slowly from the east to west as its 1st and 2nd Battalions pressed on to Walla and Meran. Between the 28th to the 30th, Merrill's end-run force began the long, grueling advance upon Ritpong. K Force moved out on the 28th of April, H Force on the 30th of April. The so-called trail over the pass was actually a lesser route used by the Kachins. Some places there was simply no path. 20 pack animals slipped and fell off the narrow, muddy way. It was a grueling march for the men who had already marched 500 miles and fought several battles, most of the time on K rations. Before end-run force reached Ritpong, it had only contacted with the Japanese once. A few of the enemy were flushed from cover by the 1st Battalion 80th Regiment, but it was feared the Japanese held Ritpong in strength. On May the 5th, the Japanese 2nd Battalion 114th Regiment made contact with the K Force at Ritpong, roughly 16 miles northwest of Nusupsup, where a four-day battle ensued. The battalion was forced to withdraw to Tingkrukang, about 8 miles to the southeast. There, after several skirmishes, contact with the enemy was lost for a period of 5 days. On the 5th, when the leading elements of K Force were a mile from Ritpong, Colonel Kiniso began an envelopment to hit the village from the north and south. The 3rd Battalion managed to cut its way through the woods and place itself across the southern approaches to Ritpong on the 6th. Meanwhile, the 89th Regiment tried to take Ritpong from the north but failed. Next day, an American reinforced company attacked Ritpong from the south but stalled by a machine gun nest. Merrill's Marauders would block the trail to the south while the 80th Regiment continued to hit the enemy positions. As the Chinese captured Ritpong on the 9th, M Force had only one skirmish with the Japanese. They routed them and began to cut their own paths. The march was fatiguing in the extreme. Half the animals died of exhaustion or fell into gorges. The men were further harassed by fevers and dysentery, but they were only 2 days behind H and K forces. To the south, General Letang's Chindits were continuing Operation Thursday. Yet under the overall direction of Stilwell, the Chindits were no longer a quote-unquote special force. Now they were a line infantry tasked with the traditional role of advancing and seizing well-defended objectives, for which they did not have the training nor the equipment to do so effectively. Brigadiers Brody and Ricketts' men covered the General Chindit movement leading north. The plan called for the closure of the Aberdeen, Broadway, and White City strongholds before the monsoon season broke. It was now the turn of Brigade 14 to play a major role. The new block near Hopin would cut the road and rail link to the town of Mogang. Meanwhile, Major Master's 111th Brigade began to establish the Blackpool stronghold on May the 5th. The site was occupied on the night of May the 5th, and Master spent the entirety of the following day setting up defenses. What he should have done was immediately attack the Japanese-held village of Nap Quin, just ahead of his positions. Instead, he busied himself with preparing the stronghold. It was a critical mistake, and it says much about the lack of enterprise for the brigade. Blackpool Block was finally established on May the 7th, with the King's Own 46th Column the first to arrive to the site. They came under heavy fire as they dug in. For the next 5 nights, they would be attacked by a railway unit based out of Pimba. The railway unit was using 105mm guns firing up from the valley, while troops from Pimba attacked for the next 5 nights, held at bay by the rifles and machine guns of King's Own Rifles and mortars, which Masters had gathered from other battalions, and he wielded as a single battery of 8. Despite the strong defense, in one section of the northern line nicknamed the Deep, which was at the tip of the Boar's Nose, the Japanese were as close as 10 to 20 yards from the wire. Enemy snipers took shots at anything that moved, while King's Own snipers and Bren gunners occupied hidden places among the shattered trees, firing whenever they saw a target, after which a cry would resound amid the quiet and followed, "Got him!" The Japanese brought up a single 75mm artillery piece from Pimba, at which they shelled the cap, blasting the airstrip with impunity, and setting the gliders and Dakotas on fire until May the 13th, when Masters came into possession of 3 airlifted 25-pounder guns, allowing him to finally hit back. Overhead, Cochrane's air commandos mounted sortie after sortie against the Japanese positions, but it was clear they could not maintain the ante. The dark clouds of the monsoon season were gathering in strength. After the successful establishment of Blackpool, Brigadier Calvert's 77th Brigade began advancing north towards Magong on the 8th. That night, White City was abandoned as Brigadiers Brody and Ricketts marched north to defend Blackpool. On May the 11th, Lieutenant General Takeda launched an attack against White City, but he was surprised to find it abandoned. He then advanced to the then-abandoned Broadway and onwards to Map Quinn, where the Blackpool stronghold was located. Having rushed through the empty Broadway in White City, the 53rd Division thus tore into the zone in strength. That gate as 53rd Division began pursuing Brody and Ricketts' forces. For the next few days, Master's troops continued to repel increasingly stronger and stronger Japanese attacks. This prompted Masters to say, "Where in the name of God were the floater brigades? White City has been evacuated 13 days earlier, and the 14th Brigade was supposed to come straight up here. My brigade had marched 140 route miles in 14 days to establish this block. Surely those bloody nitwits could cover 120 route miles in 13 days. Where the hell are they? Where were the West Africans? 20 bloody battalions, 40 flaming columns of chindit bullshit sat on their arses and drank, ate, and wondered how we were getting on." In mid-May, the 3rd Battalion, 114th Regiment, and the 2nd Battalion, 146th Regiment, tried to break through towards Kemang and Mitkinya to reinforce Tanaka's spent defenders, who would join in on the attacks against Blackpool. The 2nd Battalion, 2nd Field Artillery Regiment would also support their attacks. The Japanese continued their efforts to quickly crush Blackpool's block. A company-strength attack on May the 14th was backed by artillery support. It was repulsed, and the Japanese lost 60 dead. They returned the following morning with another 50 killed. Airstrikes were called in to further punish the enemy. Then the monsoon took hold and air support and supply became much more difficult. Lalagat and Halikandi were fair-weather fields. The Japanese also retaliated through a single heavy mortar, firing 60-pound bombs. Note in comparison, the Chindit standard 81mm mortars fired 10-pound bombs. Delayed by the outbreak of the monsoon season on May the 15th, the brigades of Brody and Ricketts had managed to secure the vital Kuen Salai Pass, but they failed to get close enough to provide significant support for the stronghold. At the same time, the flooding of the Namyan River would leave Calvert's 77th Brigade unable to aid Masters in the defense of Blackpool, and the Morris Force, which had successfully cut the Mackinnon Road, was too far away to the east to come into the stronghold's assistance. The monsoons had also hampered the airdrop of supplies, so the Chindits would have to make their 5 days' rations last up to 14 days. Meanwhile, proceeding from Ritpong, K-Force feinted towards the Japanese supply point at Nizopzup in order to attract the Japanese attention, while H-Force advanced directly to Mitkinya. On the 12th, Colonel Henry Kinnison's marauders engaged the 2nd Battalion, 114th Regiment, near Tingrukang. The Japanese at Tingrukang were strong enough to pin both K-Force's combat teams to the ground and then halt the Chinese when they were committed. Attempts to envelop the Japanese all failed. Since H-Force was proceeding unmolested, Merrill told Kinnison to withdraw. K-Force then picked up H's trail and followed into Mitkinya. While K-Force was fighting at Tingrukang, H-Force kept on the river just south of the village of Namqui, on the Mekong-Mitkinya Railroad and about 2 miles from the principal Mitkinyan airstrip that lay almost due west of Mitkinya itself. Despite the several brushes with the Japanese, catching informants were sure that the Mitkinya garrison was not on full alert. To ensure surprise, before Colonel Hunter and his force bivouacked before the night of the 16th, they rounded up the local Burmans and kept them under careful watch. Kinnison would reach Huk Machet by the 17th, where the colonel had to be evacuated because he had contracted a deadly mite typhus, dying shortly after with shocking speed. In all, 149 men contracted this little-known scourge. While M Force was about to reach Arang, H Force began an attack on Pamati and Mikinya's airstrip on the 17th. The 150th Regiment was ordered to take the airstrip, while Galahad personnel took the Irrawaddy Ferry over to Pamati. The other airstrip north of the town was left alone for the present. The attack itself went like a service school demonstration, for though the Japanese knew Mitkinya was in danger, the actual assault was a complete surprise to them. Colonel Maruyama, the Japanese commander there, had two understrength battalions of the 114th Regiment in the town of Mitkinya and in its little suburb of Sitapur. There were 100 more men at the 15th Airfield Battalion on the north and south airstrips, 318 men from the labor and service units of various details in Mitkinya, and 320 patients in the military hospital. Perhaps 700 able-bodied Japanese were present when the battle began. They took the Japanese by complete surprise and subsequently secured both positions. As soon as Hunter considered this hold on the major airstrip to be secure, he sent the prearranged code signal, Merchant of Venice, which meant the process of supply and reinforcement could begin. Consequently, some reinforcements began to flow into the airstrip, though to the disappointment of General Merrill, most of these were engineers and anti-aircraft instead of much-needed infantry. Back over at his HQ, Stilwell was jubilant. The brilliant seizure of the McKinney airstrip was the height of his career and a grand climax in the North Burma campaign, as his forces had driven 500 miles into Burma by this point, and they won engagements against 7 Japanese regiments in the last 6 months. Stilwell's triumph also came right on time, as American planners in Washington were beginning to adopt the British position suggesting to end the offensive action in North Burma. Stilwell's bold strike at McKinney would instead see the Americans issue a directive encouraging Admiral Mountbatten's command to exploit the opening of the Lido Road, and to secure enough of North Burma to protect the Allied hold of China's lifeline. After the capture of the airstrip, Hunter immediately sent 2 battalions of the 150th Regiment to take McKinney proper. 1 battalion of the Chinese 89th Regiment, which had arrived from Lido, would defend the airstrip, while 2 battalions of the 150th Regiment attacked McKinney. The other battalion of the 150th Regiment would be kept in reserve at the strip. They would encounter the 114th Regimental HQ and its 1st Battalion. As early as 5 o'clock on May the 17th, Colonel Murayama had brought the 3rd Company, 148th Regiment, the 56th Division, across the Irrawaddy to reinforce McKinney. Following the wrong road, however, they went to Sitapur instead, where they were ambushed by the Japanese. Upon encountering the Japanese rifle fire, they lost direction and engaged in fighting amongst themselves. Furthermore, some marauders would continue towards Ziyun to secure the ferry crossing south of the city. On May the 18th, as more Chinese battalions were flown in to reinforce the Chindits, the 150th again moved against McKinney, but repeated the same mishap of the day before. The Chinese became confused, fought amongst themselves, and ultimately drove themselves right back out of town. Nonetheless, the siege of McKinney had only just begun. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, if you're still hungry for some more history-related content, why don't you check out my Pacific War channel over at YouTube. I'm thinking of releasing in a week from now another podcast I did with some friends where I badmouthed General Douglas MacArthur. Typical me. It's actually not a great idea to release these types of podcasts on YouTube. They don't tend to do as well as regular videos, but I'm hoping some of you will go check it out. For the video itself, I used some AI artwork, I know that's naughty naughty stuff to do, to create a weird bar. It's actually made to look like a war-torn Japanese bar in World War II. And 2 of my buddies were there, and we had a few drinks, and we did a few podcasts that day. One of which was just me, as I said, badmouthing Douglas MacArthur. It's a rather funny one, so please check it out. Also, please check out my booming Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where you will find exclusive podcasts. I have had a surge of people coming over from this podcast and other places. A big thanks to all of you. You guys are awesome. The lowest tier over there is $2, and it gets you access to the exclusive content such as the podcasts. I think it's worth it. You can even try a free trial for a month, so please check it out. The invasion of Hollandia and Aitape were quick successes and allowed the Americans to bombard further islands. The Takeuchi convoy improved the transportation of troops, but it also came at a horrifying cost. The loss of such shipping was yet again the paint on the wall for the Empire of Japan. Despite this, the Imperial Japanese Navy was fully committed to forcing a decisive naval victory.